calling the meeting to order. Meeting of the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee. Are there any additions, changes, or modifications to the agenda? If not, the agenda is approved as presented. The minutes that you see before you were slightly modified over those that were sent out. The change in the minutes is our, the single change is in item C, the fourth paragraph, the actual statement of the motion. And the change that's there is it now reads, it after the second line procedures manual, it now reads without the sole source provisions, which was the way that Mr. Linton proposed it and we passed it, and not the way that the minutes were sent out. It is the way that the minutes now read.
Move approval as revised.
Is there a second? All in favor?
Thank you, sir.
Aye.
You're so kind.
Opposed? Minutes are revised. The general manager would like to make a couple of statements. Mr. Cato?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the last few days, there's been video as well as discussion concerning texting, operator texting, and the operation of a Metrorail vehicle. WMATA has had a longstanding policy that prohibits that, and in the last 2 days, I have had the opportunity to review all of our policies concerning cell phone use as well as texting. And as a result, I have directed our staff to make a change to the policy. And that change is there are no second opportunities. There is a one-strike rule that will be in place. The use of a cell phone for texting or for non-agency approved communications and the operation of a Metro revenue vehicle has always been prohibited. Now the consequences of using that are far more severe. And so effective with the notification to the proper union officials as well as our employees, any use of texting and the operation of a vehicle will result in immediate termination. This is something that I have looked at with a great deal of care to make sure that we are as safe as possible and that the action is appropriate, and that's the action we will take in the future going forward. In addition, there has been discussion concerning what system that we have here in comparison to other systems around the country. Specifically in California, the BART system, there's been stories about what they have and what we do not have, and I have had the opportunity to talk with the general manager of the BART system, and my staff have had long discussions, multiple hours of discussions with the technical people at the BART system itself, and I'm asking David Kubitschek, Assistant General Manager for Rail Operations, just to give a brief overview of what is and what isn't of the system that BART has in comparison to the WMATA system.
Okay. Good morning. Whenever we first had the question posed to us about BART, it was that they had two separate train control systems. And at that point in time, our comment and position was we were not aware of that, that they basically had one primary control system, but we did want to reach out and talk with them to just to verify what was taking place. And our initial assumption was correct. They only have one primary train control system. They do have other augmented tools that are utilized to help enhance their system. They're specific to their system. They're not available, you know, on the market. Their original train control system is different than ours. It's a different manufacturer altogether. And throughout their build-outs, they have had different components, different manufacturers that have come on board and provided different systems. What they go through is very unique there in the Bay Area with their configuration. We did share ideas on how we use certain diagnostic tools and controls and everything else, and so we're on a common theme and common thread there, but what they are working through there is a little bit different than what we have here, you know, based on equipment configurations.
Well, Mr. Kubitschek, that was sufficiently vague, I think, that I'm not quite sure I know what you said.
Okay.
very, very clearly for the benefit of those of us that would like to really get a very solid answer.
Yes.
If I understand correctly, at the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, they have a train operations and a train protection system similar to ours. Is that correct or not?
Yes, they do have a system.
And there was an article that said that beyond that, there was what seemed to be an operating system which checked to see whether those two systems were, in fact, operating correctly. That's what I think most of us read. Are you saying that does not exist at BART?
They do have a diagnostic tool. It is what they call non-vital. The train control system in itself is considered vital. This is basically a backup type tool that is looking for additional indications. WMATA, we have a, based on our system configuration, we have a primary train control system, and we also have backup diagnostic tools that we've been working on and developing and implementing as well.
Okay, let me try one more time on the second part of that.
Okay.
The diagnostic tools that we have, we use when we choose to use them, like once a month or once a week or once a day, whenever we think it's appropriate to use.
Yes.
Is the BART system running, their diagnostic system running all the time, or is it when they choose to use it?
It's a combination of.
It runs.
They do run reports all the time, and they do have specific events that they review, just like what we do here.
So are you saying there is no difference between what we do here and what they do there, or there is a difference?
There is a difference based on technology that they have.
But in terms of functionally and performance-wise, is there a difference?
No.
Okay. So functionally and from a performance point of view, you're saying what they do and what we do is basically the same thing, and that they run diagnostics, we run diagnostics, they don't have a system that is yet another level of backup beyond the levels that we would have.
Again, to be clear, as clear as possible, there is a certain level of technical application that is very unique to their system that is different than ours. They run automated tests, and they have automated diagnostics, and they have certain efforts and reviews just like what we do. Are the systems exactly the same? No. In theory, are we trying to be proactive in searching? Absolutely, yes.
Mr. Graham.
Well, I want to commend you. You should be a lawyer, you know, that type of question.
You meant that as a compliment, I take
it. I meant it as the highest compliment. If the BART system, whatever the BART procedure, if it had been in place at the time of this collision, would it have made any difference?
At this stage, with the investigation still ongoing, I cannot, could confirm.
So you're not sure?
No, sir.
You're not sure. And is it the word that the term that I hear used all the time is fail-safe, that this is a redundant system that would have protected, our trains in a situation such as what we confronted in the collision? Is that true or not true? Is it a fail-safe system that BART has that we don't have?
We both have fail-safe systems.
No, is the BART system a fail-safe system that is different than the one that we have?
It is different from the standpoint of the technology is different. Again, the problem that we have is, to answer your question, is our system fail-safe until we know exactly what the... Obviously, something happened. Something did not work. And given that, we don't know what it is yet. Our system did not detect that until after the accident when we ran the test itself. It's kind of like an apple and orange. I'm trying to describe the way the configuration of the two systems and what they have as tools to do a diagnostic test on it. Part of the issues that I know that BART has is that this system causes longer delays. If it detects a problem in one of their train operations, they have to go into a manual communications in order to fix it, and it does not allow high headways or multiple train operations with short distances between those trains. So it's not a system that would be compatible with ours. And it's very technical, and it's a technical discussion I had yesterday, which is beyond my ability. And that's why I asked our engineering staff and our rail staff to talk with them. It is hard to make a comparison on these two systems because they're so radically different. Had we have had their system, it would not have worked here. And that's...
So whatever they have in addition to our system, we could not simply install.
We could not use the system they have. Theirs was developed specifically for BART over the years since 1973.
I think the we don't mean this to be an academic discussion, because unless there's a direct relevance to what happened in terms of this train collision, then it's obviously not as meaningful as it would be if there were such relevance. But I think the further question, and I'll conclude on this question, is that people are asking is, to what extent have we checked in with other systems? You know, I mean, why, for example, with the BART system, why did it take a media publicity before we contacted them? Why, knowing the similarities, the question continues, knowing the similarities between the two systems, the question is, why hadn't we been in touch with them before that time? And let me just add as a second part to that, what other systems have we been talking to? What other external experts are we consulting with?
If I could, on that, we're aware of, say, for instance, throughout the United States with train control across the board, in theory, they all operate basically, the same. But whenever you start installing them physically, in rail systems, everybody has different grades. Everybody has different power requirements. Everybody has different weather environments and stuff. They are all kind of tailored and tweaked specifically for their actual operating environment. So the fundamental issue here is that what is viewed from an industry perspective, from a fail-safe mentality, this is what caused this incident. And it has the entire industry extremely concerned. I've spoken with countless, authorities, throughout the United States, and everybody's anxiously waiting to see what we actually find out, because this could have a ripple effect because of its criticality. And whenever they do install these systems, like I said, I cannot stress it enough, is that fundamentally from an engineering status, that they build these systems, consistent. There's, different ages, different technologies. Some are microprocessors, some are all relay-based. So they're all over the spectrum, but whenever you get into the fail-safe complexity of that, there's a lot of people very concerned, along with us, on what actually, took place. And that's why this investigation is so intense, and it is ongoing at this level of detail, because it is a huge concern.
But so why haven't you consulted BART before?
Mr. Chairman, if I can respond to that. We've had discussions that I've been involved in with New York, Boston, Atlanta, Los Angeles, because I talked to them yesterday. I don't know what discussions took place before then. But those are the discussions I have had. And as we have communicated, it's our intent to bring in experts from around the country, including BART, to review our system and its configuration. That review cannot take place until the National Transportation Safety Board completes their investigation first. That is very clear, and that those are the procedures and those are the rules that we're operating under. That must be completed first. If not, not only perception, but their position will be that's an interference in their investigation. And we're not going to interfere with their investigation. Once they are done, we're ready to move to bring in the industry experts, but we cannot do that until the first phase of the investigation is completed.
Ms. Hutchins?
I thank you for the discussion. And I just wanted to make clear was that we are not talking about redundant systems. We're talking about diagnostics. Is that the difference? I know it only because in some of the communications that would seem as though it was implying that it was actually a redundant system, a system that took over to protect
yeah,
when that failure.
That, whenever the question was first proposed to me, it was like they had two separate, you know, independent systems, and that is not correct. They have one train, primary train control system, and then you have a set of diagnostic tools that supports the system.
And so what we're looking at is another system that has a different set of diagnostics, but the end result is the train operation control piece is still there.
Yes.
But you've got to find the results to that.
That is correct.
I'm trying to think of an application that we all use, and I get, my mind isn't working right for that. If there is, I mean, I want to be clear. I mean, again, we're getting into the details of this. There is some connectedness. I mean, the diagnostic aspect has some connectedness to the control system, but it is not a separate, independent system that can run on its own to control the railroad operations. But there is a connectedness.
Mr. Zimmerman.
I think that the intention here has been to try and show light on this issue and clarify some things, and I fear we may have complicated things for some people. I want to take one stab myself at seeing if I can get this into simple terms. What people think they have read in the newspaper is that although the investigation isn't complete, at the heart of the problem is something that happened involving a track circuit, that there's something that happened on in that block that meant that a system failed and so a train wasn't seen. That's what people have read in the newspaper. And what they read the other day was that another system, another rail system, has a backup that if the thing we had had failed, would have kicked in. That's what I believe I read in the newspaper the other day. Now, that brings several questions. Number one, is that true? Is there something in place in the BART system where if the kind of error people think might have occurred here did in fact happen, that their backup system would have taken over or would have shown that the train in that scenario would have been different? Does BART actually have something like that?
Since the investigation is still ongoing, you know, we do not know the exact cause of that.
If that were to happen hypothetically, does BART have something that we don't, nobody else has, that is a backup system like that?
I am not aware of a standalone system that would have been, that is out there, that is superior to what we have at this time.
So I think the question we would like to know, which maybe you don't know the answer to, is, was that post report accurate? I mean, I think we want to know if there is, in fact, another train system that has a backup for something that may or may not have failed in this case. But even if it turns out it didn't, we'd be concerned about its possibility. That's the first thing. Was the story accurate, or is it not accurate? That's number one question.
Let me try a lay person, a non-engineer's approach at this, and have to be careful of some of this, of what we're saying.
I'm not asking what happened here on June 22nd. Okay. I'm asking what happened every day in the area rapid transit system.
As it was explained to me, it is not a rail control system. They have a tool that, if certain circumstances, and I don't know what all the circumstances are, I don't know if they're the same circumstances that happen here, occur in the BART system, it will not take over control, but it will send some type of signal to the controllers that there's something going on. I mean, to what degree that is, I'm not technically competent to be able to say. It doesn't take over control of the system and automatically kicks out the other system and continues to operate that system.
Turn on a flashing yellow light to tell somebody there's a problem. Obviously, you don't know the answer to this, and it's clearly complex and not as simple as perhaps, at the very least, as appeared in the newspaper story. But I do think you need to find the answer to the question. Do they have some kind of backup system to this thing that we and apparently nobody else has? And so that's the first thing we need to know. Of course, then the question is, can there or should there be such a system? I don't know about that. One of the things that struck me was, if the answer is yes, there is a backup system or something that, you know, could be problematic, and the story seemed to indicate that the reason they have it at BART was because 30 years ago they had a problem. If we, you know, we haven't had such a thing, there have been several NTSB investigations and sets of recommendations over the years. My question was going to be, in all those recommendations, did any of them concern this kind of system? Did NTSB ever tell us, you know, BART has this thing and you ought to have it here?
The answer is no. Of the, all the reports that I've read, and I've read them all and gone over them and looked at the recommendations, no.
I think there's a, there's an important summary here. And the summary has to do with what we have, and correct me if I'm wrong in terms of my understanding of what we have as a fail-safe system. And it's really a multiple redundancy system. We've got the automatic train operation, which tells us, tells all the trains where they should be, how fast they should be going. Is that right? That's the main thing that makes sure that our trains are in fact operating where and how they should. So it would maintain a reasonable separation among trains just in the process of telling them where to go and how fast to go. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's a centrally operated system. Then beyond that, we have automatic train protection. And it's out there on the tracks. And it says if for some reason you're not getting the right signals from automatic train operation and two trains get too close to one another, it stops the train. It makes sure that the following train does not go to where the lead train is. So we already have one backup equivalent to what people are saying perhaps BART has.
And the automatic train protection is in both ATO and manual.
Okay. So yeah, and it occurs even if the automatic train operation is not going, it's still there. Then beyond that, we have operators who are observing, and to the degree that they see that there's a potential for an accident, they have the ability to stop a train. And we have people at Central who, if they notice the two trains are getting too close together, have the ability to warn the operators that they need to take an action to avoid an accident. So we have at least three and perhaps four different ways to make sure that accidents of this sort should not happen, which implies that when an accident of this sort does happen, there has been a failure or a set of circumstances where multiple different things have occurred that then result in the kind of accident that happened in this particular case. And that's why this is so difficult to look at, is you can't just say this one thing failed, this one track circuit failed, and therefore everything went wrong. You have to look at all of those various issues and say, why did multiple things occur that caused four different levels of being able to do this protection not to cause this accident to be averted? Is that a reasonable summary of where we are, regardless of where BART is?
I was wishing I could have given it the way you did. That was a very good description of, mm-hmm. of exactly the way the system is set up and what occurred here.
Okay, so what we really have is a multiple redundancy system that does in fact provide a set of protections, and our concern is how could multiple events occur? And I think the general manager has said many times, this has got to be one of those very odd circumstances where a set of multiple events occurred that allowed all of those systems simultaneously or sequentially to not prevent the accident. So and I think that's what this investigation is all about. Can we move on to our actual action items? If we may, the first one is the approve the Red Line Segment Rehabilitation Contract. Mr. Couch.
Good morning. The purpose of this morning's briefing is to bring back an action that we started a year ago for a concurrence to send to the board for approval the first Red Line Rehabilitation Contract. By way of background, this provides a different methodology for us to go ahead and affect our State of Good Repair and Replacement Program. It puts us on a basis of having one contract to do all the work for a particular portion of the segment system. It does it using a single track operation to provide minimal delay to any of our customers after rush hour in the evening. And it starts with the oldest part of the system, the core of the system on the red line, that goes from DuPont back around to Silver Spring. To review the timeline that we went on, it was last July that we came to the Board of Directors for authority to initiate the contract. We went through a process that was a contractor qualification process. We wanted to be very thorough and make sure that we used the best value methodology to be able to come up with the best qualified firm to be able to do the work. That went through a first step of qualifications that was completed in November, and then we went through a technical and pricing phase with a series of proposals and negotiations that brought us to conclusion at the end of June and provides us with the basis now to go forward with a recommendation for that first contract. As a way of reviewing what we proposed last year, we had estimated a base price for that contract with the scope that was identified at the time of some $96 million. As we've gone through the year and looked at what has come up and different issues that are around the system, we've identified specific additional items that weren't in that contract as a result of reassessment of some of the electrical equipment, some things that we found as a result of reporting issues back on the orange line, and also some things that are escalation. Copper has gone up 150% in the last 18 months. So there's a high escalation on the portions of this that are the electrical transformer related type items. That's led to a growth of some $30 million on that base. There is an offset in two areas. One is some of the faster work that we've reevaluated in the area that we really need to do that work is in the outer red line out near Grosvenor, and I'll cover that later in the presentation. And the second piece is that we're proposing to come back to the board sometime this fall with a presentation that will go with an energy management type of contract to look at a systems basis for lighting upgrades that would, at that point, be able to reduce this and do all the lights across the system. What that comes back to is an adjusted value looking at what that scope would be. The comparable number is $115 million to the 96 that we presented to the board last July. As we've also gone through this, we've looked at other things that were beyond the original scope that we brought forward. It's things that are critical and that we really can't wait until the timing would be right for a second contract. The first is the DuPont escalators. Those are original escalators that are really one of a kind. They're APB Baker units. There's three at DuPont and three at the Pentagon. What we've done as we've gone through this is these specialized units that require special order parts are really the hardest to keep up and operating and in a state of good repair. So instead of doing a rehabilitation, what we're proposing and what the cost would be is to replace those units with standard units. That would give us better reliability and also interchangeability of parts. Similarly, at Foggy Bottom, again, off of the red line, but one that has been a great concern and an issue with reliability because of the fact that this is a single entrance station, is the Foggy Bottom station. We have three units there that are very high reliability problems. These are O&K units, and the concept here in lieu of doing a rehabilitation is to do a replacement. This is one of the locations that we did not have a canopy over the top of the escalators in the original program. So as we replace those three escalators, we also will install a canopy over the top. The wellway is also wide enough that we can get an additional vertical circulation element in. So as these escalators are replaced, then the proposal is to closer space the units, and we'd be able to add a set of stairs. So there would be three escalators and a set of stairs that would now go into this single entrance station. The cost for that, including the canopy and the stairs, is approximately $8 million. We've all seen the areas on the system, particularly on the outer red line at Shady Grove and Rockville, where we've had severe deterioration of the concrete platform. This work is beyond the limits on the red line that the current contract was approved for. But in the timing and the sequence for doing this, we can't afford to wait until what would be the third red line contract to effect this repair. So it's proposed to be included in this contract. We're fortunate in that there is $16 million worth of stimulus funding that's been identified to do this work. So this would allow the work to be done at both Shady Grove and Rockville to do the structural rehabilitation of the platform and also to go to the new tile that we did the test program at the Tacoma Park Station. In addition, there's other traction power equipment, principally transformers, at three locations on the Blue Line down towards Springfield that have failed and are in need of replacement out of sequence, and also some other units on the Red Line up along the area up towards Shady Grove. That's an additional add to the scope, and the projected cost, or the cost of that, would be $4 million. I referred earlier to a change that didn't do the proposed not to do the track fasteners in the original area of the contract. The more significant area that we have of deterioration is the area between Medical Center and Grosvenor. So on a most need basis, this is the area where we have the most deterioration of the system. It's the hard rock tunnel area where you get the inflow of groundwater and chemicals that come with it that's caused severe deterioration. So that's the area that we would focus on to do the track replacement, and that would be a $4.9 million cost. If I take all that and summarize it, it takes what we came to the committee and the board with a year ago, with an original projected budget for the base of $96 million. As a result of the variations in cost and things that we've done that were in the original scope, it's a $19 million increase. When we take the other items that really just can't wait for other contracts, that takes the total increase and would bring a base contract to $159 million, which is part of the Metro Matters program. The other component that we put in the contract was a series of options. The first phase, and the principal reason for these being in there, is that the scope of these was work that was to be done after the original Metro Matters program was completed. It was work that, as a result of the life cycle and the replacement needs, was to be done from fiscal year 11 and beyond. But as we're starting this new approach and this new sequence, we've identified items in each one of the four phases for the Red Line contract that would be included as options to be exercised subject to availability of funding, which really jumpstart us on that work as we go forward. The first phase of it really needs to be done at the beginning of the project before the next funding agreement could be in place. And it's the work that is from Rhode Island Avenue around to Judiciary Square. So in that case, we've identified, again, under the stimulus package, the funding to be able to do that work. It's work that is beyond the original Metro Matters program, but it fits into the schedule as we do that work over the next 12 to 15 months, really getting started in advance of that next Metro Matters program. There's a series of items that are here, and it's everything from the CCTV, PA, and also work on the automatic train control systems. So the recommendation is to exercise the option for phase one at the time of award. We still have phases two through four that would be proposed to be exercised in the future as the new funding agreement is available. They are for discrete items of scope that are beyond the area that is between Rhode Island Avenue and Judiciary Square. They contain items of work that is work on the train control system, the CCTV, and the PA. And by having this, it really gives us that flexibility in this existing contract to add whatever work is necessary as we move to the future. That takes me to a summary of what the award would be. It's the recommendation that we would do the base with the additional items and also the phase one option. The funding comes back to Metro Matters and also the stimulus funding, and the recommendation is for $177 million award. That basically is the recommendation to come to the committee and to be advanced with your concurrence to the board.
Mr. Couch, thank you for a very thorough, as usual, presentation of all the pieces. Let me ask two questions. One is, you talked about all of this money coming from Metro Matters, yet some of it is in the out years, that's 11 through 13. Are you saying that this is funding that is available within Metro Matters and will be obligated before 10? under the Metro Matters total, but will only be expended as part of the tail, so it's consistent with Metro Matters?
Yes, that is.
So this is entirely within the Metro Matters program that ends this current fiscal year?
That's correct.
Okay. And as this project increased in size and cost, are there other things that we were originally planning to do that we now will not do?
There's several items that we've looked at in here. The principal ones that are identified are the items for the lighting. There also is some tiebreaker work on the traction power side that originally would have been done. But in order to provide the funding envelope to be able to do the additional base items, those are things that would be done later in other contracts.
So they would be part of the follow-on to Metro Matters?
That's correct.
So we are postponing those items because we believe that they are not of the same priority as this?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think you went through a list of those.
Do we have a specific list of the items?
There are, on the system, there are 92 tiebreaker stations. They're throughout the system. That's one of the major components because the main add to this really is on the traction power side. That's the principal component. I can provide a specific list.
Could you make that available to the committee, please?
Yes.
Thank you. And so what we are now going to do is in setting priority, well, let me back off. You're saying you have got enough money to do a full obligation for all of this through the combination of what is available in Metro Matters and stimulus, right?
Yes.
And in so doing, yeah, I'm just going to leave it at that. Okay. The second question I have, and then I'll go to Mr. Graham. The second question I have is one that I told you I would ask you when you first brought this to us. At the present time, people on the Red Line are having rather difficult time with our levels of service, and it's a discussion Mr. Francis and I will have after this meeting. What's going to happen when we do this? I noticed that you're going to start curtailing service at 8 o'clock in the evenings.
What we've looked at, Mr. Benjamin, as we went through this, and we discussed it when I made a presentation to the JCC, was what would happen to the headways. We specifically looked, and the way that this program is put together is basically work between interlockings. So we've looked at all the areas that are in this program, and for all of the areas, with the exception of the area between Judiciary Square and Farragut North, we are going to be able to hold the existing wider headways after 8 o'clock at night. So there will not be any effect on the customer service. The area that is between Judiciary Square and Farragut is the area that it would take a wider headway, and we're looking at alternative ways so that we don't have as much inconvenience as that could be. That headway could be more than the current headway that we have after 8. We're looking at starting that work at 10 or later.
But you're saying at this point you believe that the normal headways, not the ones that we're running on the Red Line today, are ones that you believe you can maintain effectively until 10 o'clock at night?
We've reviewed with operations the headways after the end of rush, after 8 o'clock, for all the areas except that center portion between Judiciary Square and Farragut, and we can hold the after 8 o'clock headways, including the work that's on this program, by going through a single track operation.
Mr. Francis, you wanted to say something.
Yes, I just wanted to say that part of what Mr. Kyle said is fact. When we went through this process, one of the things we did not want to do is have any disruption by customers, as you're well aware of that in our talks we had before. So we built this plan based around the type of headway that we could hold after 8 o'clock and after 10 o'clock. So Scott is exactly right. The maintenance work that took to be done will be around what our schedule is.
Okay. And I hope that will show up in the minutes so that I can hold you to this a couple years from now. Yes, Mr. Cato.
Since I know you're going to hold us to this a couple years from now, I just want to be clear that we will adjust the headway. So there will be some headway adjustments. Because you cannot work on an active railroad where you have tracks, just one set of tracks going in each direction, without some impact, and the impact will be more time between trains, but we will hold that schedule that we announce. And it's at a time that you have the lower ridership. The number of people impacted will not be as great, but head weights will be expanded.
I hear something a little bit different between what Mr. Vance has said and what you said.
Isn't...
Okay.
I want to be clear.
Get the answer there.
Okay. And Mr. Cato's right, too, because at times, as you well are aware, this schedule was built, this work was built around the schedules presently have between 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock. But at times, we may have to adjust the schedule based on some work that is being performed, in which fact that we will make sure that we notify our customers and make sure that information gets out. Because there are things that could come up during the maintenance that that we're not aware of now. So,
would you also please look at your scheduling of those pieces of work, as per the last discussion we had about work that's done on a single line, so that you don't sequentially cause disruptions, so that people just get done with one and they get another one, and it just goes one after another after another. Mr. Graham.
Yeah, just one clarification, then I want to ask my central question. But in page 10 of this report, it makes it clear that you're going to single track during the week, which is Sunday night through Thursday only. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So there'll be no single tracking on the weekend?
The normal work window for this project is going to be Sunday night through Thursday morning. There may be times in some of the work that we may have to do some single tracking on weekends when we're doing work that goes through one of the crossovers. But the primary work window for this will be Sunday night through Friday morning.
Right. I have a recollection, admittedly a little vague, of this being already included. I didn't recall it being $177 million, and I think your explanation of what you have added to this satisfies that question in my mind. But we had this before us in the last year, did we not?
Yes. Our first briefing on this to you, Mr. Graham, was in July of last year.
It was July of last year. So, but it was, how much was it? What was the price tag at that point for the work?
Our projection for the base was $96 million. Our projection for the base plus the options was $145 or $147 million.
But what we were looking at was about $100 million.
Yes.
Is that correct?
For the base, yes.
Now, this, of course, this is the red line, and this is the line on which the collision occurred. Is there any of this work which is directly relevant to recognizing, I don't want to get into legal issues, but recognizing we don't know what the cause is and so on, I want to get to that in a moment. But is there any of this that is directly relevant to that collision?
Mr. Graham, until we know what the root cause for the collision was, it's impossible to answer that question.
We know some of it is clearly not relevant. I mean, the escalator replacement is very good news for DuPont Circle and Foggy Bottom and so on. There's no question about that, but that doesn't relate to any collision issue.
There is work in here in the option portion that is for train control, that would be for processor installation in some of the stations. Whether that is relevant to the accident is beyond what we have knowledge of right now.
See, that's my question, which is, you know, we don't know the root cause of the collision as yet. We don't know what the probable cause, to use the technical phrase that the NTSB will be using, what the probable cause is. Thus, we don't know what kind of costs will be attendant to fixing all of that. And so while I support all of this, and it's clearly, I mean, this is the whole case of our capital improvements laid out in part, the types of things that we really need to do and what we need this dedicated funding, capital funding for is, here's part of the case right in front of us right now. But I'm a little bit concerned, particularly that since our chairman has brought out the fact that there are other projects, a list of which you're going to give us, that are necessarily going to have to be put off while we do this. Thus, we have a priority setting process in place right now before the committee. But I'm a little bit concerned about taking this action because we don't know what lies ahead in terms of potential costs relating to this collision. And do we?
Mr. Cato?
No, I wish we did, but I do not. I was not going to say that. I was going to let you finish, and then I had a comment.
Well, that was about, I mean, it was almost at a period. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that to say here we're going to spend $177 million setting aside other priorities which we previously believed in but we no longer think are as important as this, without knowing that issue, is this prudent?
In my judgment, Mr. Chair, yes it is. This system has tremendous needs of capital improvement. And if we delay to wait for another, we might get so far behind we cannot catch up. I'm very aware and very mindful of the aspect of what the cost could possibly be, and I have no clue yet, as a result of this accident, of what we have to do from a capital standpoint. Should we find that the cost is X, we will bring recommendations of how we fund that. But while we're waiting for that, and if we fail to maintain the system and keep moving forward, we could create far worse situations.
Yeah, but just to give an example of what I'm talking about, and this is far-fetched, admittedly, but I'm told to replace all the 3,000 circuits on this system would be $1 billion. Now, I don't think, I can't imagine having to replace all those circuits, but it gives the flavor of the type of thing that we might have coming down the pike, and here we're actually approving a contract, which will take $177 million worth of capacity off the table, and we might reach the point very quickly, and I'll conclude on this note, we might reach the point very quickly where we realize that there's even a higher priority than this being a priority to set aside other priorities.
Mr. Couch.
If I could, Mr. Graham, what this gives us is a capability that we currently do not have. We will have a contract in place, if this action is approved, that has a very qualified contractor that can do everything from electrical to train control work, that has the area of the accident within the space of that contract. Mm-hmm. So whatever is identified and whatever the funding source has to be, we will not have to go through a process to advertise and select a contractor. We will have somebody on board if you do approve this action.
Mr. Chairman. Cato.
And I understand where you're coming from, Mr. Grant, and your concern. The $1 billion cost for the signaling system is everything. That's everything that we have that's involved in the signaling system. We don't know what's going to be required. Should we find that we need these capital dollars to respond to what occurred as a result of the accident, we have the abilities to switch projects around. We will come back for that modification to do so. This contractor would not have an issue with that. The contract amount would be the same for them. It's just that we would get them to do something different. I don't know what we're going to have to do. I just know we have to continue to move forward to maintain the system that we have and also be mindful that we do have some expense coming up, but I cannot, it's like I have a leak in my kitchen and it's flooding the floor, but I'm not going to fix that yet because I need to find out what's happening to my electrical system. I have to fix that leak, and then when I find out what it's going to cost to do that electrical system, I have to make some other priorities within my budget to be able to fund that and to find funds for it.
Ms. Hutchins, followed by Mr. Yule. I think Mr. Wilton had his hand up also.
Thank you. The general manager kind of concluded the place where I hope that we'd all be, because I think what we're seeing here is the movement of, I think, the prudence that we've been trying to show from the prior, and that we're moving through the Metro Matters piece that was originally. And I think we were all handed the budget book of completion, and you go there and you see the capital commitments that were already planned. So this is moving that forward now. And I think it's no more than what is an example of what we've been challenged with or what we have decided our priorities here. And that is, we've defined a clear capital improvement piece that needs to be done in order to put this system continuously in its best operating mode. And whatever comes out of the investigation is next. And I think you've said it exactly the way I wanted to when I decided to comment on this, that this is what we should be approving, and I think it is consistent with where we've been before. So I think I have only one question, and our budget indicates the areas that will have the improvements, and you have indicated the station-specific ones. Is there any additional data that shows where we're going, lists that are going to show as we move through the system for these improvements? I assume you pulled the ones that are there as priorities?
We have a similar list and a similar package. Another contract that will be coming back sometime this fall that will be the blue-orange line. That will be followed by one that will be the green line. We came to the committee and the board in December with a similar package for bus garages, and there is another one that's under development for rail yards. So this is the sequence and the timing and the content on each one of our lines and each one of our maintenance facilities. And there is a similar list of work for each one.
Mr. Yule?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I concur with what both Mr. Cato just stated and my colleague. Mr. Graham raised some very good points, but we have a responsibility to go ahead and move this project forward. You can always go back, whether it's the same contractor or a new contractor, and add on for corrective measures that may or may not be necessary at a future date. But I think to not move this project forward is just, you know, it's to hue and cry that we've been getting from the general public that, you know, Metro's, it's been an unfair hue and cry that we failed to be responsive at appropriate times. Here we know that there's a need on the red line. It's been bogged down with problems for, you know, past several years now, and you know, opportunity to move forward, make these corrections, and do more. I think what's important that we don't have here, at least I haven't seen it in the documents here, is a timetable. And you may verbalize it while I was reading my BlackBerry, but I think that will be helpful in terms of, you know, maybe by the time this project actually begins to get geared up, we'll know something in terms of what corrective measures we may have to take that could be timely as a simultaneous response. So, thank you.
Mr. Lynch?
I don't know if I need to comment anything at this point. I think it's what needs to be said, as this is. The only thing I will say, though, is that I was listening to our general manager talk about the challenges of operating a rail system at the same time that you're required to maintain it. And there is a tension that will always be there. But I would hope that our customers would understand that there's a responsibility and an obligation of this authority to maintain it. And yes, sometimes that will mean inconvenience. Sometimes that will mean changes in headways. But there's no other way of doing it unless you shut the system down. And that's just the reality of the railroad. And as much as we would like to be able to predict all of that, that's not predictable either, because once you do operation and maintenance, you will sometimes discover things that you didn't know at the surface. And that, too, may require some adjustments in your scheduling. So I think it's, you know, kind of unrealistic for us to anticipate that we're going to be able to issue a headway schedule that's going to stay the same throughout. I think the best that we can do is try to be sensitive to the operating needs of the public and inform them as best we can so that they can make adjustments in their own schedules to accommodate the needs that we have to maintain the system. And the other point I would make is that historically the federal government has done a condition and needs report that has talked about how much it takes to run and maintain our systems. One thing I will say is that there has never been the need for the condition and needs report has always exceeded the availability of funds. As a result of that, systems are always operating with what they know they need, but having to operate with what they have. And most recently, they've decided to do what they call the state of good repair, which, quite frankly, is the same thing. But what it pretty much says, and I think this is illustrated of the discussions today, is we are kind of walking along trying to, with a Band-Aid, maintain a system that needs major surgery. And when you do that, you stick a Band-Aid where it's bleeding now, but you know that there's just gas and cancer that you're not getting to, and you're trying to do that as best as you can, and you're making deliberate decisions day by day, month by month, and year by year, when in fact you need a huge infusion of dollars just to maintain what you have. And, you know, being a former elected official, I know how everybody likes ribbon cuttings. That something new and shiny is always great to do, and everybody shows up. But nobody shows up when you have to do a signaling system or a circuitry, and there's not a lot of attention and money for those kind of efforts. And that's where our problems are.
Ms. Hutchins.
I just wanted to add one other comment, because when I read this last night, I thought about it. And as I got off the train this morning, I thought about it again. And that is the point Mr. Linton pointed to, is communicating with our customers. I think it would be really great if we could make sure, as we continue to do this, that we have a communication plan and that it is visual. And it is very visual. For people who use the system every day, they kind of understand what you see and that those repairs are going on. For people that don't, they kind of figure out, why in the world would you take my elevator out at this time? And I think it should be so graphic that you can't get on without recognizing that this is a good news piece, and it's the investment that we're making in the system. So I just hope that we'll continue to stay on it. It's something Mr. Graham has said repeatedly. I think we have to do a better job at that communication, because we're being judged, and really I think we should be having that judgment based upon the good work that we're doing, and not the perception that we're just interrupting the flow of our customers' use of the system.
Mr. Graham.
Yeah, just very quickly, I agree with everything everybody has said, but I just want to say one thing. We're going to run out of money. We've already run out of money, you know, and the action before us right now created new priorities and set aside other priorities that heretofore this board approved. So, you know, come on. You know, that's just the reality of what we're dealing with. And you know, I don't want to have the, what is this, the faucet leaking all over the kitchen floor?
That was my metaphor.
I want to fix that. God knows, don't anybody quote me as saying I'm against the DuPont Circle escalator. I don't want anybody saying that. Is the examiner here? Oh, no. Just a little levity in there. But anyway, the point is that there's just so much money. And,
yes.
And I don't know how the rest of your crystal balls are doing, but mine isn't real clear on the dedicated funding for FY10.
No.
Mine is not real clear. And even with 9 people dead and 80 people injured and $150 million in the Congress is a blink of the eye in the federal budget, but has anybody seen any life to $150 million? Please let me know about it, because I haven't. I know we're having a hearing next week before a committee that has no appropriations authority.
And it isn't about funding us.
And it isn't about funding. It's just simply about oversight, which is important. I'm in favor of oversight. But anyway, you get the point. I mean, we just, you know, we have so much money, and here we're spending a huge chunk of it, and I just hope that we have more, you know. But I don't see it happening in FY10. And so whatever, we're shooting our shot here, and it better be well aimed, because we don't have a lot of $177 million coming. That's the only point I'm making, and it's kind of obvious, but I thought I'd repeat it.
As Mr. Graham pointed out, we have before us an award for $177 million. Are you actually prepared to award? Do you have a selected contractor or set of contractors?
Yes, we do. Yes.
Is there any interest on the part of the committee to know who they may be? Or shall we just...
Yes, I think so. Who is it?
The prime contractor is Mass Electric. They're a major national, international firm, subsidiary of Kiewit & Company. They have a whole series of very qualified subcontractors. Mass is the contractor who was one of our 2 installation contractors for our traction power system upgrade that was done over the last 3 years.
Is there any major subcontractor that you already know?
that a lot of this work is electrical.
And this was completed? This was completed?
Yes.
At $177 million?
Yes.
Is there a motion to...
How did we approve that?
Is there a motion to award?
Last year.
Last year.
But did we approve $177 million last year?
No, we approved $97
million. Well, wait a minute. There's a technical issue here. We approved $100 million. You competed $100 million. Mm-hmm. How do you have the authority now to award $177 million? That's nearly double the amount that was competed. I'm not following something.
The process that we went through, I went through what the comparable cost was to the $96 million worth of original scope. That price is $115 million. That's a higher price. Okay. Then there are other items that were a price was obtained that we cannot award those items, such as the DuPont escalators or Foggy Bottom, without board approval. So we have a price. We cannot include them without any approval from the board.
But
which
there's,
is this
there's $60
action,
million
is this
dollars that has not been competed.
It has been competed.
Been competed, but it has not yet been awarded, is what they're saying. They were actual items that were added on in the process after the original estimates.
And competed.
That's
yes.
What we're being told. Do we have a motion to award? Mr. McKay.
I just have a question going back to Mr. Graham's original comment about the project's list of things that we're postponing.
Mm-hmm.
When could that be made available to us, and would it be a bad thing if we acted on this next week instead of today once we have the ability to look at that list first? I'm a little uncomfortable acting on this until I know what's being postponed. I have no problem with the concept, with the project. I think we have to do it. I just want to know at least what other things are being deferred.
Mr. McKay, let me suggest that we are doing nothing other than sending this to the board. So we could send it to the board requiring that information be provided before mm-hmm. the board acts. Otherwise, we would have to have another meeting of this committee.
The board can take things up to respond.
Were you going to make a motion, Mr. Chair?
Okay, I move that we authorize award of this contract to the noted contractor and appropriate subcontractors, subject to the provision of information to the board prior to the board meeting on those projects that will be or that have been eliminated in your analysis in order to cover the costs that are here within the total of Metro Matters.
And one other change to the motion.
Okay.
I'd like to see the chronology of the RFP and how it went to how all $177 million was completed.
Is that okay, Mr. Couch?
Sure, of course.
Is that okay with members of the committee? Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nobody's opposed. Let's go on to our next action item. This is for a reimbursable set of projects for the Huntington parking structure and the Vienna station. Mr. Harko.
This is item 3B on your agenda. There's actually two standalone parts to this. We have a PowerPoint presentation leading up to a resolution that's on page 32 of your package. I think I can summarize pretty quickly what these are. The Huntington parking structure is actually a reimbursable project budget for a garage that opened for business last summer. There are some residual contract claims that need to be funded. This action would increase the budget for that parking garage reimbursable project to cover those residual claims. The second action would be the creation of a new reimbursable project for the Vienna station to put a staircase in place to handle passenger crowding that's out there. Both of these are fully reimbursable projects and are funded by the respective jurisdictions.
Mr. Harkin, could you describe very briefly what money is being moved around in order for this to occur?
Yes, sir. The increase in the Huntington parking structure budget would be $1.3 million coming from two sources, just less than $100,000 of funding coming from the West Falls Church parking garage budget, which is not needed. That also is moving towards closeout. And $1.2 million of funds on account, primarily interest earnings, that have rested with this. The $2 million is new funding coming from Fairfax County.
Question? Let's see if Fairfax County wants to move that one.
Oh, yeah. There.
Yeah, I'd be glad to move approval of the recommendations 1 and 2.
Ms. Hutchins, do you want to second that and answer the question?
There's a second and a point.
Yes.
I think we also need to make sure we include in the resolution that it is up to $2 million for Fairfax County.
Could we modify the resolution?
Absolutely.
I'm sure of that. Okay. Any other comments? Mr. Zimmerman.
What was the revision in the summary?
The revision, we need to add $1.3 million to the Huntington parking garage budget, and it's coming from two places. There's just less than $100,000 being transferred from the West Falls Church garage project budget, and $1.2 million of basically funds on account here at Metro.
So it was clarification of those numbers that got revised?
Yes.
Document.
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Ayes have it. Certainly, Mr.
If I could just have a point of privilege. We've just been joined by the interns from my office, some of the interns from my office this year. And we also have interns, Mr. Fuller, who is the director of Mass Transit in the Department of Transportation, has brought his interns. So can all the interns stand up so that you can be acknowledged by the Metro Board, please?
Welcome. We hope you enjoy what we do here. Our next presentation is on our DBE goal setting and also on the small and local business programs. Mr. Navarez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last May, the board slide, please. Last May, the board approved our public commentary period of 45 days as required by the Code of Federal Regulations 49 CFR 26. Our outreach efforts as part of this public commentary period included our dissemination of that public notice beginning on May 28th, which was the day that the board approved it, and also a press release letting everybody know of our public meeting that was held on June 26th. We advertised the proposed goal and the public meeting, and also we solicited public comment via our weekly email alerts. The public responses were very positive, and we're delighted that they were so. And next slide, we are recommending approval of the DBE goal of 25% for the federal fiscal year 2010.
Mr. Chair, let me just note, can we stop here and approve
yes.
the goal before you give the rest of the presentation?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Graham.
I move approval of the 25%.
Let me raise one issue before
Thank you.
You do your motion, if I could.
We can discuss it after
okay.
the motion.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
No, you have to.
I note that we are moving this forward before the comment period is complete. Comment period does not end until the 13th of July.
That is correct, Mr.
Chair. So it seems to me that if we're going to do this, we need to do it with some provision that says that if significant comments still come in, the board will be so notified.
Absolutely. We will notify the board.
Part of the motion, since we are technically moving it before the completion of the comment period. With that modification to the motion, any other questions or comments on the motion?
I just want to say, over the years, you know, we've had fluctuations in this goal, and there are various other aspects of this, but this is a very important action today, and I'm very pleased to see that we're maintaining our level and that we're not dropping our goal in terms of minority-owned and disadvantaged businesses and local as well, to see what we're doing here. And so I commend the authority for bringing forward the same level of commitment that we have had previously. I can remember it being as low as, do I remember 21%? I think I do. And so we are strengthening this commitment over the years, and that's appreciated. Thank you.
Mr. Lane.
I'm happy that we have a goal that's consistent with the federal requirements of evaluation and determining that goal, and the fact that it's yield 25%, that's also good as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your support.
You appear to be ready to vote. All those in favor, aye.
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 And opposed? Anyone opposed? Second part of this presentation is
Thank
on
you.
Small and local business programs. Mr. Griswold, are you going to do that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Good morning. The purpose of this presentation is to provide the committee with an update on Metro's small and local business program. Next slide, please. Metro's small and local business program is designed to enhance opportunities for small business within the transit zone, the District of Columbia, the State of Maryland, and the Commonwealth of Virginia. The small and local business program was adopted by Metro's board in October of 2005. It provides preference to qualified small and local businesses on non-federally funded purchases under the simplified acquisition threshold, which is currently $100,000. While we work closely with the DBE program, it is worth noting that the small and local business program is separate from the DBE program that you just heard Mr. Navarez discuss. During the bid evaluation process, 5% is added to the pricing of all vendors that do not qualify as small and local businesses. That number is then compared to the prices offered by qualified small and local businesses. Next slide. As you can see from this slide, the program has experienced solid growth both in terms of real dollars and percent of total purchases. 47% of dollars spent on purchases under $100,000 are spent with small and local businesses. This amounts to over $145 million over the past 4 years. It appears, however, that fiscal year 09 saw a temporary end to the annual upward growth that the program has experienced every year since its beginning. I say appears because I should note that the figures for June are only through the first half of the month. Normally, June is a high volume month, so I suspect that the final dollar totals for the year will be higher than in fiscal year 08. We will be analyzing results for fiscal year 09 and looking to see what may be the cause for the percentage drop. We'll be looking at the conversion from our old vendor registration system to the PeopleSoft vendor registration system and our transition to e-purchasing, and what impact that might have had on both the number of vendors registered as well as their opportunity to participate. We're also looking at some of the more efficient contracting methods that we have employed this past year, such as the purchase of kits for the New Flyer Midlife Rehab Program. Kitting is a more efficient buying process that ensures that all the parts, for example, the parts that are required to complete a transmission, are available to the mechanic and usually at lower overall prices. We have also purchased Cummins engines for the same overhaul, and those engines have been purchased under a major contract. As you recall, the small and local business program applies only to small purchases under $100,000. Regardless of what our analysis discovers, staff intends to come back to the committee later in the year and recommend changes to the small and local business program that will add small and local business participation for procurements over $100,000, similar to the structure of the DBE program. After several years of solid growth, we don't want to lose our momentum. Next slide, please. Here's a breakdown of the $145 million by jurisdiction, as well as a breakdown of the participating vendors by jurisdiction. And again, those fiscal year 09 numbers will increase as we get the final results from the last 2 weeks of fiscal of June. Next slide. Next slide.
Yeah, let's just go back to that slide for a second. And I appreciate this report very much.
Thank you, sir.
I'm intensely interested in this local requirement. As you know, it took a lot of effort to get this into place.
Yes.
And heretofore, we were awarding a lot of these smaller contracts to businesses outside of our regional jurisdiction. But what I'd like to know, and maybe you don't have this with you now, is the number of actual vendors in each jurisdiction who have received this money.
There is a breakdown, sir, at the bottom.
We have 2,900 registered.
Right.
But, oh, I see. So
15% are in the district, 448. 57% are in Maryland.
I'm talking about those who have actually received money.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
This is the number registered.
This is all that are registered.
Right. I'd like to know by jurisdiction those who actually got the money and the contracts.
Okay.
And if we could, do you have that information available to you?
I'll have to check, sir, to be quite honest with you. PeopleSoft reporting system leaves a little to be desired, but we will do what we can to provide you those numbers.
Or another computer project. but I want to know how many firms actually got money, and then I want to know the amounts of the contracts. Because these contracts are not actually for under $100,000.
Yes, sir. All of the small...
Every single one?
Yes, sir. This program only is for non-federally funded purchases that are under the simplified acquisition threshold.
These are not grouped?
No,
I was under the understanding that you could group the contracts and so that you could award for different particular reasons, but in a group contract.
You can do some of that, but again, it's only as it's currently structured for purchases under $100,000. That's why we want to come back to you later in the year and look at including the small and local participation in those contracts that exceed $100,000 and capture more of that, similar to what is done in the DBE program.
So let me have that information.
I will, sir. And finally, the last slide, our program success is largely attributable to our strong outreach program. On this slide, you'll see the numerous events that we're participating in, culminating most recently in the Procurement Opportunities Fair at Prince George's Community College on June the 17th. We hope to continue to grow this program in the years ahead. Thank you very much, and I can answer any questions.
Are there any other questions? Okay, this was a presentation that requires no action. Therefore, let's move to the next presentation on the Resource Efficiency Consultant. Ms. Burnside.
Good morning. Under action item 3D, we are requesting board approval to initiate and award multiple consulting contracts and modify existing contracts if appropriate, to identify, recommend, and implement improved organizational efficiencies in fiscal year 10. In the way of background, over the last couple of years, we've focused on increasing our revenues and decreasing our expenses while continuing to deliver safe and quality transit service. We realize that in the next couple of years, in the current year and in FY10, we have extremely challenging budgets and that we have to do more with what we have. So we'll be looking at providing service more efficiently and productively. Next slide. In terms of the types of efficiency consultants we're seeking under these contracts, we'd be looking at organizational design, organizational measurement, such as KPIs, metrics, service level agreement development for support departments, manpower planning, process reengineering, management systems, and employee tying that all into employee performance management. And I kind of wanted to talk about some of the things that we've already done. So this is not new for Metro. We've already been down this path over the last couple years, and to kind of remind you of the work that we've already been doing to implement efficiency improvements. In the area of organizational design, as you know, the general manager had an organizational assessment done when he first came on board in 2007. And that resulted in a number of changes to refocus the organization to operations and away from a construction-focused organization. Additionally, the bus organization was reorganized, and that eliminated 5 layers of management and introduced clear lines of responsibility and accountability for key service quality positions. In the area of measurement and employee performance management, we've introduced clear departmental safety goals. And in FY10, we've actually introduced specific safety goals for individuals that are weighted in their performance plans. Process reengineering. We've reengineered under the process improvement teams for our partnership with DuPont, the return to duty process, aligning the responsibility with operations, and improving the process to ensure injured employees' rapid return to duty. We've also improved the eligibility process for access. And I believe after this presentation, you'll hear about procurement streamlining. So those are just a couple of examples of things that we've been doing, certainly not the entire list. Going forward into FY10 and then further into FY11, We would like to increase the focus on measurement and goal setting, establishing key performance indicators and metrics that have customer service, service quality, and safety at the core, but that also effectively measure asset utilization, efficiency, and financial factors. For example, if we looked at asset utilization and efficiency, measuring a bus or rail operator's productive time relative to pay time is very important, and we would like to do more of that. Manpower planning, we'd look at creating staffing models, where, at what cost, reviewing the management of the extra board. Process reengineering, we're going to look at all the processes that Metro has that cost the most money currently, and look at how we can get the highest return or savings on these processes by improving them. And examples, specific examples that we'd focus on immediately is bus and rail scheduling, operations planning. And then finally, establishing a Metro management system, which many folks know as sort of ISO, TQM, lean type processes that give us a framework of processes and procedures to ensure that we fulfill our tasks, identify nonconformities, and deal with those. And just to kind of talk about the magnitude of possible savings, as you know, as you heard through the budget presentations for FY10, we focused on staffing in operations and looking at overtime. And as a result of that effort, which we would want to continue, we were able to save $18 million in the last budget year going into the next budget year. So I think the potential for savings is great in looking at all these different types of efficiencies. As far as the recommendation, the recommendation is to approve the initiation and award of all procurements associated with FY10 program deficiency activities in a total amount not to exceed $1 million. And that is included in the FY10 budget.
Is there a motion to approve? Are there any questions first? Mr. Lund.
From being a former manager, I think it's always important to examine yourself on a regular basis. And I think, the safety effort, the organizational effort that has been done in the past has reaped some real benefits, both in terms of efficiency and cost savings. So these efforts are actually a small amount of money that actually comes back with a significant amount of return. One question I had, though, it's up to $1 million not to exceed. Are you thinking about a series of contracts and consultants along this area, or are you looking at one, or are you looking at, because there seems to be a magnitude of various skill sets that will be required to meet the goals that you've laid out here. So is there going to be a series of opportunities here? And
right. The answer is yes. We're looking at, obviously, these do require kind of different skill sets. And so, between 3 to 5 different consultants over the year, I would estimate at this time.
It would be a bench of consultants.
Right.
And it could be a number greater than that. The main focus we're going to have, of course, is on the organizational efficiencies, but looking at the scheduling aspect of services, paid platform time, those type of focuses we're going to look at. So it could get broader. This is the cap, and we did put the budget within my budget, so the control would be there.
I so move, Mr. Chairman.
Second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? This one is approved. Our next item is procurement streamlining. This is the item that we have discussed this somewhat before. McKay made a proposal which basically the staff is coming back with, fleshed out a little bit more, complete with reporting to the board on these issues. And so this is our examination of the item that we asked not to be sent to the board and that we are now considering in detail. Mr. Griswold.
Good morning. The purpose of this presentation is to request that the board grant the general manager authority to initiate and award non-competitive procurements up to $1 million if included in the plan of contracts submitted with the annual budget. As way of background, on June the 25th, the board approved the fiscal year 2010 operating plan of contracts. As you recall, the plan of contracts is a list of all contracts over $100,000 that we anticipate awarding in the upcoming fiscal year. The board granted the general manager authority to approve the initiation and award of competitive procurements included in the plan of contracts, regardless of dollar amount, but did not grant the general manager authority to approve non-competitive contracts at that time pending further review and assessment. And just for reference purposes, the operating plan of contracts that was approved by the board contained 140 contracts, 8 of which were non-competitive. So that gives you kind of a feel as to the percentage of non-competitive contracts that we're talking about. We briefed the Jurisdictional Coordinating Committee during a conference call on June the 18th and again in person at the JCC regularly scheduled meeting on June the 26th. We have addressed all the issues raised during those meetings, and we are now recommending that the board grant the general manager the authority to initiate an award non-competitive contracts up to $1 million as long as the procurement is included in the plan of contracts.
First of all, let me just ask a question there where you are. When you say if included in the plan of contracts, is the intent there and to identify those as potential non-
And to identify. You'll see that as later in the presentation. But, yes, we will identify the non-competitive contracts. And, again, they're only proposed at that time. They go through a full vetting process that we will show you before they're actually determined to be.
But we would see them always before they when they were in that program. Did we see those in the set that was – I don't remember.
We didn't highlight them when we presented this back on June the 11th.
Could you, between now and the board meeting, provide that to us?
Yes, sir.
So that we just get the revised version of that program
sure.
with these identified?
We'll do that.
It doesn't display. We're just going to have to do paper.
I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead.
That's fine. In your handout is a flow chart. I'm not going to go into
Is there going to be a quiz on this?
No, sir. I just wanted to show you what we used in our discussions with the Joint Coordinating Committee when we went through the process for the approval and the checks and balances on sole source procurements. We discussed this process for reviewing and approving non-competitive procurements and the built-in checks and balances in that process. And the checks and balances are comprehensive. First, First, the criteria for non-competitive procurements are set forth in the compact. We are adding a new provision that's requiring the sign-off of the statement of facts at the assistant general manager level. Okay, now we're back up. The document is then reviewed and signed off at three levels. At the contracting officer that will actually sign the contract, it goes to general counsel for a review of legal sufficiency, and then it goes back to the Office of Procurement for sign-off at one level higher than the original contracting officer. In addition, the Office of the Inspector General conducts attestation audits on all non-competitive contracts over $250,000. That may be waived between $250,000 and $750,000 if you have sufficient data to determine the reasonableness of price. But above $750,000 on non-competitive procurements, an audit is mandatory. And finally, Metro is subject to a procurement system review conducted every 3 years by the FDA, and we are scheduled to have that review in 2010. One of the features that we have added at the recommendation of the JCC is some additional safeguards, including a quarterly reporting to the board on non-competitive contracts. And as Mr. Benjamin pointed out, proposed non-competitive contracts will be identified in the plan of contracts. The plan will be available in sufficient time for thorough review by board members. A report will be provided to the board on a quarterly basis on non-competitive contracts that are included in the plan of contracts. That report will list the contractor, the scope of services, the contract amount, the period of performance, as well as a basis for non-competition. And finally, the procurement regulations will be revised to include this reporting requirement for non-competitive procurements. In conclusion, we request that the committee concur and forward to the board the resolution implementing this business process improvement and revision to the board procurement policy granting the general manager the authority to initiate and award non-competitive procurements up to $1 million if the procurement is included in the plan of contracts submitted with the annual budget. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Just two notes on the last two items that you mentioned, or the item that you mentioned where you said that you were going to put this in the procurement regulations, yet what we're passing does not include it, nor does the procurement regulations as we pass it say that you have to identify the sole source contracts in the plan of contracts. Could you put that in there somewhere?
I think the resolution includes that language, that the non-competitive procurements will be identified in the plan of contracts.
Ralph, well, I think you can clarify it. It says shall be listed, but we could also say specifically identified.
That would be helpful.
Right.
Thank you. And you might want to do the same thing in the table that you've got, you know, where it says if it's, where's your table? On page 69.
On page, yes.
You know, where it says less than a million. And instead of just saying not on the plan of contracts, not so identified on the plan of contracts.
Right. Okay.
So that this lasts longer than this discussion and is part of the process.
We can do that.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman?
Just on page 62, the according to the board, it's a slide. It says the third item says plan of contracts will be available in sufficient time for thorough review by the board. That's a good thing.
Yes.
Well, how much time is involved in a sufficiency?
The board votes on the plan of contracts at the last meeting in June. There's a standard mail out. We hope to provide that at least a month prior to when you would have to vote on that. Actual development of the plan of contracts starts as early as December and works through the spring as contracts are identified during the building of the budget process. So we can cut that off and at May, for example, and provide you with that information.
So it would be more than a month.
It could be.
That,
yes, sir.
That would be good.
Just depends on what the cutoff time is.
One, I think that that time frame is reasonable, but saying sufficient is pretty vague. So,
okay.
You know. And the other part of this is it's not only the board members get to see it well in advance, but frankly, for something like this especially, that the relevant jurisdictional staff see it, because that's really what.
That's correct.
Something like this, we're all going to look to the people who work with us who know the technical details more. So, you know, we often summarize that by saying JCC needs to see it. But that's not really about the JCC as a body seeing it necessarily, although that's a way to do it. It's like the people who represent the jurisdictional staff, they need to see it so that we can rely upon their, rely on them as a sort of a second set of eyes.
Yeah.
Thank
you. We can do that.
Mr. White?
Let me just say, you know, when this came to the board, there were some questions, and I think you've done a good job in terms of both laying out a process so that you accomplish your goals. One is to streamline the procurement, but you also are sensitive to the board's needs to make sure that there's a process in place that gives some clarity, some transparency, and making sure that we have a system that has this kind of protections. So I think you've done a good job of that. In reference to the flowchart comment that Mr. Graham made, it takes me back, and to young people in this room, when I used to do programming, and we used to have paper cards with beige computers that was large as this table, and I had to punch card, and we had to actually do programs with these type of flowcharts.
And drop them off in one
drop,
day.
Yeah, hope they don't fall.
Find out one card was punched wrong, and again. Do it all over again.
I spoke to an engineering student one time, and I mentioned punch cards, and I think the room, the kid looked at me like, what is he talking about?
Kids think I'm kidding.
But this is very helpful to me.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Well, I remember the mimeograph machine. And I've used it. You thought it was pretty special. Am I right, Mr. Cato?
Unfortunately, I recall those too.
I think non-competitive awards is in a class by itself. And I know you've given us the flow chart to show at a glance just how careful everything is and how well examined it is. But, you know, I look at that at a glance and reach a different conclusion, which is after you go through all that, what's the big deal about adding the board of directors of this authority in the case of a contract, you know, of this amount that is non-competed? You know, so I reach a different conclusion from the one which I think you intended me to reach. And I think whenever you have a single authority deciding something like this, you know, there is a reason for special care, even though it's maybe not as much money as we're accustomed to dealing with. So I'm not, I want to think about this. This is going to go before the board. I'm not sure I can, you know, you haven't said what is the compelling reason. It's 5.7%. I think if I remember correctly, it's a very small number of contracts. It takes up a very small amount of our time. We typically deal with it under administrative items. I mean, what's the big deal is the first question.
Well, I think there's certainly an administrative time savings involved in cradle to grave and getting the contract awarded by having the general manager with the authority to award up to $1 million. I think in looking at the controls that are in here, I think there is in fact more visibility and transparency in the process we've outlined here than necessarily how we've had in the past. I think a huge element is in getting the signature as to the statements of fact at the assistant general manager level, and then the three other approvals that have to be looked at to make sure that it passes all of the compact legal tests to make sure that it is a valid sole source.
Yeah, so, but see, all of that, lengthy process in the flowchart is different than the board, and it's different in one critical element, is that this becomes publicly visible.
Mm-hmm.
It's for anybody to come, and even though we might dispatch this issue very rapidly on a consent, it's still on the public agenda. It's noted as such. There's a possibility of public scrutiny and so on. None of that occurs at the other levels. I don't know. I'm not yet convinced, but I do agree with Mr. Linton. Did you hear that part? I do agree with Mr. Linton that you've done well in terms of addressing the concerns that this committee raised previously. Could we have incorporated into the resolution the 2 points on the plan of, and I know Mr. Zimmerman has pursued this successfully, plan of contracts will be available with some time frame for thorough review by the board, and then the quarterly report, could we include those in the
quarterly report is there?
I think they're in there.
Yeah. Right at the bottom.
And that document, sir, will be publicly available as well as we move the budget process forward.
The other one?
Just modify the other, modify the statement to say.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to vote present on this today if I just conclude my statement because and between now and the board meeting, if you would like to flesh out to a greater extent the compelling reason for this, I want to consider that, but I'm not prepared to support it right now.
I also want to thank the staff because they did, in fact, take something that was just sort of thrown in there originally in the changes, and you fleshed it out, and you've made it a lot more substantive, which for those of us that have got to carry the fiduciary responsibility the board does, makes it somewhat more comfortable to deal with, admittedly, an area of procurement that, as Mr. Graham correctly points out, is different from competitive in the sense that it is open to an awful lot more criticism and potential manipulation, and I think you've done well in trying to deal with all of that.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. McKay, you were originally the one that proposed the $1 million level. Are you still feeling comfortable with that?
I am, actually, and I was going to move approval of this item.
Go ahead.
I move approval.
I have a second.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Would you report voting present?
Okay. We have one. Mr. Graham is voting present. That completes our action items, I believe. Our information item is the monthly financial report.
Yes, sir. In your package is the May monthly financial report. I'll touch on some of the highlights for you. We're obviously 11 months into the fiscal year, 1 month left to go. The books of the authority have closed upstairs, so they're already working on the year-end results. Through May, total revenues have come in basically on budget. Expenses are hovering about 1% under budget or better than budget, and it's generating about a $16 million surplus at the subsidy line item. I can't be sure exactly what that number will be as of the June 30th close, but obviously there'll be some amount of surplus. Per board policy, the first use of that year-end surplus would go into the operating reserve. Touching then on ridership on a year-to-date basis, Metro rail ridership has grown about 4%. Metro bus ridership is up about 1%. Metro access ridership has grown about 22% so far this year. One minor note on ridership, we didn't quite get the springtime pop on rail that we normally get from cherry blossoms through June, July. We normally get a pretty big hot bump. Ridership's growing. I'm not saying it's not growing. It just didn't kind of happen as dramatically this spring and early summer as it did last year. Last year at this time, kind of every week, we were announcing new record-breaking days. Didn't happen this year. However, I'm happy to report on the 4th of July, last Saturday, we did set a record. Last Saturday, we carried 631,000 people to the fourth event, and it's about 5% higher than last year. And again, it was the highest 4th of July ridership ever.
Presumably, during the month of June, we will have run up some additional expenses associated with the accident that will probably reduce the size of the subsidy savings that you're showing here, at least through the end of the fiscal year. The other thing I'm concerned about is the continuing variation that we get in bus ridership and bus revenue, which is unexplainable, and I do hope we will get to the bottom of that reasonably soon, because it just keeps going and going and has now been going for 6 months or so.
Absolutely agree.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman.
The rail ridership in the spring, I guess this might be the consequence of the rest of the country being in a recession.
It could be.
I'm not asking you to speculate on it. It's entirely consistent to me.
We've already looked at it a little bit. It really is the peak ridership that hasn't grown this year.
My question is actually about bus.
Okay.
And Mr. Benjamin just made a point on that. But one of the things that I have not seen analyzed on either a, say, annual basis, when you look at the year-over-year number, or on a long-term basis, is the changes that have occurred in the reach of our bus system over that time relative to the ridership. So that, you know, if we look over a period of the last 10 years, Metrobus ridership has had some growth, but, you know, not dramatic. It's, you know, a little better than flat or whatever. But that obscures the fact that in that period of time, a lot of what was the Metrobus system 10 years ago isn't the Metrobus system anymore.
Right.
We probably actually had a lot of growth in bus ridership that you're not seeing, because a lot of what used to be Metrobus is now Connector and Ride-On and other things. And no one is actually collecting that I know of and showing comprehensive bus data for the region, which, by the way, I think we should be doing. But the narrow question here is just, if you looked at the year-over-year figure, and in that period of time, for instance, did Fairfax take over some route or routes in that time? And does that somehow affect the totals? And I don't expect you to know that off the top of your head.
No, it's a good, it's an interesting question.
Because it affects, you know,
right. We'll look at
the
it.
Way we interpret some of the numbers.
Okay.
Anybody else?
I just wanted to note that particularly from the connector service and actually we're in the middle of actually at the end of and completing a transit development plan, and we've had to adjust those numbers for the mere fact that we've made those shifts. And as we start looking at this year, we will find, I'm sure, a different, even a greater sense of growth. And you will reflect the,
yes.
That loss. So I think that,
absolutely.
That's a very critical part of it.
Yes, Mr. Carter.
You know, just following up on what Mr. Zimmerman said, you know, the new D.C. circulator route, which originates in Woodley Park, Adams, Morgan, you know those neighborhoods, I'm sure, is already the number two circulator route in the District of Columbia, 57,000 rides. Am I right, Mr. Fuller? In May, approximately, give or take a few. So, you know, and we're serving, of course, the area of Adams, Morgan, Woodley, and then down 14th Street to McPherson. So there are 50,000 rides there in a month that we're having a very successful route. I mean, ultimately, that's got to have, unless there are new people parachuting in, you know, to take the bus. You know, but I think we're also attracting people, such as myself, quite frankly, who previously would drive because now there's a route that is really helpful.
We are most pleased to hear that, Mr. Graham.
57,000 riders, and Jim Graham is there. So, but I think the point is, and I don't mean to make light of this because this is. You could make light of it, but it's. But anyways, we need to. We really do need the analysis that Mr. Zimmerman is referring to, because you know I have wondered, and I continue to wonder, as chairman of the Committee on Public Works and Transportation, you know, just you know, what is the future of the DC bus company, as I call it, and you know, the same thing has already happened or is happening in our sister jurisdictions. And, you know, we're looking, I mean, why shouldn't we take over the most attractive routes in the District of Columbia? Why not? You know, and you know, this whole scheme needs an attention, which I hope to bring it.
We did, Mr. Graham, once do that in our regional bus study. And we did, in fact, at that time, establish criteria for what would be regional routes and what would be non-regional routes that Metro would run. But we did leave open to any jurisdiction to take whatever service it felt it wanted to take.
Yeah.
I would note that many of those services are now discovering that it's more expensive to run a bus system than they originally thought.
I think on the whole, the system...
It's not a moneymaker, I can tell you that.
No, well, I think the point, though, is that the system actually, I think, has worked really well in apportioning the routes over time, basically, to local and regional services. But there isn't a place where you can look and see how that whole system, the connection of different systems, works. And I think that WMATA, perhaps in conjunction, suggested from my colleague here, with the TPB bus committee that now exists, could somehow pull that data together and make it generally available.
Okay, we have one more item, which is this, the subsequent Finance Administration and Oversight Committee agendas. You may wish to look at that. That does pick up some of the items that we passed in our last resolution as to guidance that we will be giving the staff in September on the preparation of the 2011 budget. And we now have a motion for executive session, which Mr. Graham is going to make.
Right. I move that we meet an executive session to discuss. Contractual matters consistent with Board Procedure Roman numeral D, safety matters consistent with Board Procedure Roman numeral 6F, and personnel matters consistent with Roman numeral 6C.
We will therefore recess this this committee meeting. Should there be any action that comes out of this, which I don't think is anticipated, we shall come back. And
we have to vote on the motion.
We have to vote on the motion. And if we do adjourn the meeting, we will adjourn it from the executive session. A motion on the executive session has been made. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. We are recessed.